Hi, you're listening to another sermon from Deep Creek Anglican Church, a place to find refreshing faith in Jesus Christ. Visit us in Doncaster, East Melbourne. You're always welcome here.
Paul, to say there's something about you as followers of God, as children of God, that is in complete contrast, is foolish compared to what the world considers wise. Or what we've said in this series is, it's weird. We've had 2 weeks already. We looked at extravagant worship, wasting time, giving of ourselves and our resources in worship to God. Last week, we looked at the weird belief in angels and demons that the Bible teaches us to have. And this week we're concluding, but I think just for this year, I think we'll come back and be weird again next year, the joy of self-forgetfulness. Now, this is Father's Day, and there's no Father's Day without a gorgeous little photo of a father and a baby. Well, that's Phil and Phoebe, and Phoebe looked at it and said, I look like a bread roll. And then she said, Dad looks like a bread roll too. And then she said, like bread roll, like bread roll. Phoebe is less than a month old in this, and they are both actually asleep. But one of the selfless things that fathers do is stay up when their little ones are awake. And Phoebe has been a very wakeful child and teen, and we do, and mostly Phil sacrifices sleep because of it. Phil also is the one in our family who is particularly conscientious about making sure Phoebe is safe. Like if we're out or playing in a playground, I'm kind of the, and he's the eagle eye, making sure, you know, really heightened awareness. And it's a selfless, beautiful thing. Most of us know that as a parent or observing our own parents, that there's a great deal of self-sacrifice in parenting, a great deal of self-forgetfulness, wanting to put another first. And so you bring a child into the world, or you embrace a child into your family, if you're a blended family, adoption, fostering, and you put that child's needs before your own. You sacrifice, you work hard, you put them through school, whatever it is, you worry about them at night. And there is so much about being a parent that helps us to grow into the selflessness or the self-forgetfulness that God calls us to. But then there's the complicating factor of our twisty ego. We begin by desiring the good of this child, making sure it is fed and safe and warm, not unwell, treated for illnesses. And as the child grows, we start to put some expectations on it in order that our identity is affirmed. So maybe we want the child to grow up and get an education that we never got. Maybe we want the child to earn a lot of money, which is definitely in the trades. That is what you should do. Maybe you want the child to behave in a way that you didn't, or that reflects well on you. So our twisty ego, our sense of self-worth, our identity, starts to impact how selflessly we are able to parent. We put our expectations. We hope that the child will actually make us proud. We compare the child to ourselves or to others, to other children. We compare our parenting to other parents. We decide whether the child is walking soon enough or whether they're getting the right marks. Oh, you got an 87? Well, what did Chloe get? Oh, that's okay. She got an 85. That's just me. There's a great deal of our own twisty ego that starts to impact all of our selfless behaviour, all of our best intentions, whether they are parenting, whether they are loving our own parents, with friends, in a relationship, at work, whatever it is. And in church. So Paul here is talking to the Corinthian Christians, a new church, lots of big personalities, lots of great experiences of God. But the risk that as they bring all of their twisty ego into the church, that the church itself is in danger of being corrupted and destroyed. This thing that could be so beautiful, that puts the other first, that creates a community that is, well, what do we say, multi-generational, multicultural, welcoming, and growing, that could be stopped in its tracks by pride and our twisty ego. So here in chapter 4, Paul says this, "Now, brothers and sisters, I have applied these things to myself and Apollos," these two different leaders that they were aligning themselves with, "so that you may learn from us the meaning of the saying, 'Do not go beyond what is written.' Then you will not be puffed up in being a follower of one of us over against the other. For who makes you different from anyone else? What do you have that you did not receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as though you did not?" The great blessings that the Corinthian church had received had begun to be twisted up into comparison, competitiveness, and pride. And at the heart of it all was the ego. And so this, in the word in verse 6, "then you will not be puffed up," it's a pride word, but it's a word that's a lot more physical than some of the words that we might have translated pride in the other parts of the New Testament. And so Tim Keller, in this little book called The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness, which gives you a kind of a taste of where I'm going today, but it's very small and we need more, Tim. Well, he's not with us anymore, but there's lots of teaching online, so do enjoy it. He writes that the ego, actually as it is puffed up, is empty, painful, busy, and fragile. Empty, painful, busy, and fragile. So first of all, thinking about this idea of the pride of the person, the self-importance of the person being puffed up beyond what it ought to be, indicates, says Tim, that there's something that should be at the center of who we are that keeps us grounded, connected to how we were intended to live. But as we start to compare ourselves with others, as we start to do that twisty thing of saying, am I better? I'm wealthy, but am I more wealthy? I'm intelligent, but am I more intelligent? I'm good looking, but am I the most good looking in this room? As we do that work, we actually find ourselves further and further away from being centered at what was intended to be at the heart of human life. Who we are in God, created in God's image. And so we actually feel very empty, because there's so much room between how we were intended to kind of function and live and where we've put our boundaries, how we've decided to see ourselves. And we feel there's something wrong. We kind of, there's so much space in here. It's not filling me up. When I look to get a promotion at work, when I do my garden at home and I think, gee, this is looking good, it's on to the next thing because nothing is filling up this space. But secondly, Keller writes, it's painful. you know, if you've eaten something that isn't quite right and you're kind of feeling like you've got a very distended organ there that shouldn't be so puffed up, you can't even touch it. You know, your stomach is so bloated. You're like, don't come near me, don't touch me. Our ego, as it is puffed up in comparison to others, in boasting, in defining ourselves over and against someone else, is painful. And so when we say things like, that person hurt my feelings, actually what we're meaning is that person has come up against my inflated sense of self and it hurts. They've bumped me, they've pressed me, they've said something, they've done something, they've left me out, whatever it is, and it hurts. Because my ego is no longer the shape and position that it ought to be, I can be offended, deeply offended. And so I push people away. I don't want them to touch. It hurts. Or I react, no way can you do that to me, never again. Thirdly, an inflated ego, one that is defining itself over against others, trying to pull in comparison and competition, is busy. So just like a blown up balloon kind of just gets moved around, you know, when you see one, you've tied balloons to the letterbox for a party and, you know, they're kind of, especially at the moment, they're just moving constantly, they're butting up against each other, they're bouncing around. This is how the ego is when it is overinflated. It's moving, it's busy, it's bounced from here to there. It's never at peace. One thing we try, it doesn't work. The next thing, how am I going to define myself? Someone says, actually, this is what it'll take. We look at the ads, we look at social media. Okay, I better do this, I've got to change this, I need to do this, follow this new trend. We're busy. And finally, of course, it's fragile. I don't know if you've blown up balloons recently, but I'm an under-inflator. Because you get to that point, you're like, if I keep going, is it gonna pop in my face? And I mean, it won't do me any damage, but, you know, as they say, a tiny little fright, tiny. So I kind of keep them smaller. But an overinflated ego is fragile. And so actually, you build your sense of self on things that keep it inflated, but if it is damaged, it's gone. You lose your job, it's gone. Someone in the church talks about a particular behavior or an attitude, and you're cut to the heart, not able to see that there's no condemnation. But it's gone. Your sense of self, you can't hear anything against you. Otherwise, you're left with nothing. So Paul says there is a huge risk in selfishness. There is a risk in comparing yourself to others and in constantly trying to make sure you're the best in the room. Pride, he says, is actually going to hurt you. You're going to live with a life that is empty, painful, busy, and fragile. Now, it wouldn't be a Tim Keller book if he didn't quote C.S. Lewis. And so I always like to go back to the source that he points me to. And he talks a lot, C.S. Lewis talks a lot about pride. And he talks about comparison. And he says that pride actually is all about comparison. That you think that it's just about getting pleasure out of having something. People are proud of being rich or clever or good looking. But C.S. Lewis says they are not. They are proud of being richer or cleverer or better looking than others. If everyone else became equally rich or clever or good-looking, there would be nothing to be proud about. It is the comparison that makes you proud, the pleasure of being above the rest. And so when the Apostle Paul is speaking to the Corinthians, he says pretty much the same thing to them. You are comparing yourself to others. You are competing for who is aligned with the greatest leader, teacher, miracle worker. But comparison is going to steal your joy. So he writes earlier in our passage, do not deceive yourselves. The wisdom of the world is foolishness in God's sight. He says, so then no more boasting about human leaders. All things are yours, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or the present or the future, all are yours, and you are of Christ, and Christ is of God. Far from actually placing themselves in a higher position, in a better position, by comparing themselves to others, to boasting, to saying, we are the best, actually Paul is saying, you're missing out. By comparing yourself and saying, I follow Paul, I follow Apollos, or our faction here is better because we're into this and you guys aren't, you know, operating in these gifts or whatever it is, he says, you're missing out. All is yours. By spending your time comparing yourself to others, you're missing out on the fact that everything has been given to you. Everyone is equally good-looking. Everyone is equally wealthy. Everyone is equally gifted by the Holy Spirit. And let's go have a good look at 1 Corinthians if you want to read it through this lens. It's quite illuminating. All things are yours. You lose if you compare yourself to others. You miss what God has for you and who you truly are in him. So maybe then we think, okay, I encourage myself, my child, my friends, my spouse, to not be so proud, to think less of themselves. You know, tall poppy, I'll cut you down a little bit. I'll bring you down to earth. I'll help you to face how things really are. And me, I need to remember how rotten I am. You know, I need to remember I could be so much better. I'll just focus on those things. I could be so much better than I am. I'm not. And so I just compare myself to myself. Well, once again, actually, that's still a trap. C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity says, do not imagine that if you meet a really humble man, he will be what most people call humble nowadays. He will not be a sort of greasy, smarmy person who is always telling you that, of course, he is nobody. Probably all you will think about him is that he seemed a cheerful, intelligent chap who took a real interest in what you said to him. If you do dislike him, it will be because you feel a little envious of anyone who seems to enjoy life so easily. He will not be thinking about humility. He will not be thinking about himself at all. Part of the way in which parents counteract the comparison and the pressure that's on our young people is to say, don't compare yourself to anyone else. All that matters is that you are better than you were before, that you reach your potential, that the Megan that you are is the best Megan you can be. Everybody has different gifts. That's okay. It doesn't, if your capacity in maths is a 55, that's your capacity in maths. But what we want to do is make sure that that is the ceiling of your capacity. That's okay. Let's do that. Let's just be the best Megan you can be. But Paul would say to us, that is still putting the self at the center. you might not be comparing yourself to people in ads and whatever, and the people around or in the family or siblings, but you're still putting yourself in the center. You're not thinking about yourself less. You're just focusing your comparison right here. And so Paul would say, humility and a life that is less busy, fragile, painful, empty, is not thinking less of yourself. Ah, I need to, Megan, you're 55, can you get to 57? Or, you know, trying to just compare myself with myself. But actually thinking of yourself less. Paul says this, and it's very weird. He says, this then is how you ought to regard us, as servants of Christ and those entrusted with the mysteries God has revealed. And people are aligning themselves with these apostles and they're saying, oh, they're so great. And Paul's saying, no, we're just servants and anything good we have has come from God. We're entrusted with these mysteries and our job is just to be like household managers of this resource. But he goes further. He says, I care very little if I am judged by you or by any human court. Indeed, I do not even judge myself. My conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. It is the Lord who judges me. Now, we're used to, maybe, thinking that it's healthy to get to the I care very little if I'm judged by you or any human court. My standards are what I need to live to. I'll work them out, and then I can be rightfully proud of myself if I live up to what I want to be. But the weird thing is, Paul says, yeah, I don't care if I'm judged by you or any human court. Your standards are not my standards. My standards are not my standards. I do not even judge myself. My conscience is clear. I think my standards are okay. But that does not make me innocent. I'm aware that I also have an ego that could be puffed up. I'm aware, just like any human, that the way I think about myself could very easily be corrupted, distorted. My own standards are not the right way to make myself feel good about myself. To make myself know whether I have been faithful to God, to make myself feel like I'm living aligned with the intention that God has for me. I don't even judge myself. It is the Lord who judges me. Therefore, judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait until the Lord comes. He will bring to light what is hidden in darkness and will expose the motives of the heart. At that time, each will receive their praise from God. I wonder if you can see here that Paul is trying to take the self out of the equation altogether. It's not how I compare to others. It's not even how I think of myself. This is a tiny vignette in the midst of a larger book which is pointing the Corinthians to a great gift they have received and a great mission. God's Holy Spirit enables them to function now as the place where the presence of God dwells together and as individuals, the temple of God, he said. The way in which to function as the human being that God intended you to be is to have not yourself at the center, but to have Christ at the center, to have his spirit at the center, and to have his mission, his purpose at the center. Now, last week we looked at this weird thing of believing in angels and demons, and you can go back and listen to that if you want to. But we summarized the kind of to-do list of both angels and rebellious spiritual creatures in this way. Angels are created to worship God with free will, and to enact and protect God's good plans for his creation. So they're messengers, they bring guidance, they are antagonists sometimes to push humans in the right way for God's purposes. Demons, on the other hand, are evil spirits. Their own decided purpose is to take worship away from God, and whether that might be to an idol or whether it might be to make humans worship themselves, and to destroy God's good plans for his creation, lie, kill, destroy, steal. And so we could then say, well, our purpose, if this is what their purpose is, then our purpose as human beings is to worship God and enjoy, pursue, and partner in God's good plans for his creation. This is what it means to forget ourselves and place ourselves into the purposes of God, to worship him, to have him at the center, and to allow him to set the trajectory for our lives. But what I realized is that the risk, even in doing our 2 weeks on worship and angels and demons, is that our own puffed up ego, still as Christians, can twist the way that we engage in those things. So I thought about my own commitment to worship. And I will take myself to conferences or places where I'm not known or in leadership. It's just kind of easier, right? You're not thinking of 10 things at once. Who's here? You know, is the heating at the right temperature? Whatever it is. But I found that the extravagance that I might think that I'm giving to God in that moment, hands in the air and tears and whatever it is, I cut it short when I've got what I want. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is probably about enough. I think I can probably go home now because I'm feeling better. I've received from God something in worship. I feel peaceful. I've enjoyed the music. I feel better. I feel that I've had a revelation. Something's kind of shifted. Hang on a second. I'm still in the center of that experience entirely. That's very convicting. And maybe secondly, when I'm thinking about trying to resist Satan, stand against his works in the world and kind of act against those things, I'm much more motivated to do it when I'm having a bad week. Oh, I don't know, must pray. And then, oh, that's good. Okay, I feel better now. But what about the plans of Satan to turn the world against Christ? What about the kind of not spiritual warfare that I experience in 1 week that's feeling pretty rough, but actually what it means to see human beings redeemed from darkness and death? That's a whole other thing altogether. And I convince myself I've been engaged in spiritual warfare and resisting Satan, and actually it's, again, I'm right at the center. So I think what I wanted to say is that at the end of this series, you know, we've encouraged each other in some very weird practices. None of them actually have their noblest expression without this, without self-forgetfulness, without allowing ourself to kind of just take its small right place in who we are and to be defined by the goodness and gifts of God and our desire to see his purposes in the world completed. One of the books that I read gave an illustration. I'm going to end with this. I'm going to spend a little bit of time just in silence. And I'm going to read a couple of Bible verses and quotes from some of the mystics of the church across the ages. He said, you might not think self-forgetfulness is the path to joy, or that pride actually stands in the way of us truly being fulfilled as human beings. He says, have these two choices. You've got an hour to spend. You could spend an hour lying on the bonnet of a car, looking up at the sky and the creation. Stars, northern lights, if you've got the finances to get there. Just come and tell me all about it if you've been. I've never been. The beauty and majesty of God's creation. You've got an hour. And as you lie there, you are not thinking about yourself, unless it's to think, I'm quite small. You are just lost in the awe of this experience, of what God can make of the beauty that is outside of yourself. Well, your other option for the hour to spend is a sensory deprivation tank. Now, sometimes as a parent, you think, ooh, sensory deprivation tank for a full hour. I could get into that. But all you are left with there, nothing from outside, just this. You're busy, empty, overinflated, fragile, painful self. You might think for the first 5 minutes, this is just bliss. And then, of course, you just have yourself. I don't know which one you would choose. I think most of us, many of us, would choose to spend an hour actually lost in the awe and grandeur of God's creation. There's no mosquitoes. It's the temperature's lovely. Don't worry about that. Take some time now to ponder that, to put yourself in that moment, to think, how is it that that would be the most amazing, fulfilling, restorative, beautiful hour that I could spend? It's got to tell you something about what your soul's made for and the right place that it is intended to have in yourself and in the universe. So we'll just have 30 seconds just to quiet. And I'll just read a couple of things. He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, "He who seeks his own honor is no longer seeking God." In other words, the way to self-forgetfulness is not found by self-concentration, but by self-surrender. It is found in the act of losing oneself in the service of another. For we are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do. And Saint Teresa of Avila, self-forgetfulness is the path to true humility. In forgetting ourselves, we remember God. And in remembering God, we see ourselves in the light of truth. It is in this self-forgetfulness that we find the purest joy. Amen.